And my son also said, he works for Bear Stearns, he's out here somewhere, and he said, why is all these people coming to hear you? What do you know about money? And the but I studied for tonight. But you know, it may surprise us, I suppose, that the Bible, that my job is not to know money, it's to know what's in the Bible and Christian texts. And the Bible says probably 20 times more things about money than it does about sex, maybe more than that. So it was hard for me not to know a little bit of something about money just by trying to get at it in the Bible. I want to talk to you about filters for a second. Everybody comes at a life feeling like, well, I'm just going through life in a kind of common sense, objective way, but actually you've got mental maps. You've got mental maps. You've got assumptions about God and the universe and human nature and right and wrong and what's important in life and the relationship between individuals and community. You've got all kinds of assumptions working. It's what we call a worldview. So you're not walking through life making common sense decisions. You're not being objective. You've got a worldview. You got a bunch of deep faith assumptions about things, and that's how you're reading things, that's how you're looking at things. Now, from now on, I'll talk about money, but let me just give you one illustration of this. It has nothing to do with money. Like yesterday in the newspaper, I just read the New York Times, there was a guy that said, what I don't like about religion is everybody thinks they've got the right God. Every religion thinks, I've got the right God. Every religion says, I got the right God. So they're all equally right. I don't like religion. Now, the problem is, the only way that all religions could be equally right is if, A, there is no God, and therefore all religions are subjectively helpful, but none of them are objectively true, or B, the other possibility is, there's a God, but the God is sort of a nebulous force and has no concern about what you believe, no concern about doctrinal accuracy. So the only way that all religions could be basically true or equally valid is if one of those two views of God are true. So to say, well, I think all religions are true, and it's stupid to think you have the right view of God, is based on an assumption about God that you think is right. And you think other people, you're recommending it. There's no way to make any statement. There's no way to make these kinds of statements without all sorts of assumptions, deep assumptions about the nature of God and reality. Now, let me give you one that has to do with money. Some years ago, a guy I knew who worked for MTV discovered that his boss, who obviously also worked for MTV, didn't let his teenage daughter, it might have been daughters, I can't remember, it was one or the other, it's been a long time, I can't remember if it was one or two, but would not let his children, his teenage daughters, watch MTV. Thought it was bad for them. So my friend asked the guy and said, don't you think there's some inconsistency? You think you're creating a cultural product that's bad for people, but you are making money by producing that cultural product. And the guy says, well, maybe it is bad, but what the heck? Business is business. Now, there's a web of assumptions, a lot of assumptions in there. There's a mental map that guy's working off. First of all, there's an assumption about his responsibility or the relationship between an individual and the common good. Basically, even though the common good is not something that he's working on, his job, he thinks, economically, my job is to make money. I don't really have to think about the social fabric. I don't really have to think about the effect on other people. I don't really have to think about the employees, customers, environment. I don't have to think of any of those things, because profit is the only bottom line. It's the only bottom line. But that's based on all sorts of assumptions. For example, it's based on an understanding of the responsibility of the individual to the community. It's based on certain assumptions about what is right and wrong, kind of a relativistic approach. It's based probably on a certain assumptions about God. It certainly doesn't assume there's a God who will hold anybody accountable for things like that. In other words, when he says business is business, that sounds very common sense, very hard-nosed, but it's actually an enormous web of assumptions about God and about morality and about right and wrong and about the relationship of individual and community. It's a worldview. Nobody can make decisions. Nobody can even do business without doing it off of a worldview, out of a worldview. Now, what I want to do tonight is I want to say, what's the Christian worldview when it comes to wealth creation? What does the Bible have to say about it? if you are convinced that Christianity is true, if you're convinced in your Christianity, you need to think this out, because you probably work in environments that do not have the same mental maps. The people you work for, the people you work with, don't have the same worldview about money. And there's a great danger that you will seal off your faith from the way you work. In fact, there's more than a great danger. You know, every day you'll be asked to do that, to seal your beliefs about the nature of the world off from how you work. Tonight, what we're just going to do is we're going to look at some of that, and we're going to look at the Christian worldview, and just to help us reorient ourselves to what the Bible says about wealth creation. If you're not sure Christianity is true, it's always helpful to have somebody put forth a particular worldview, because it forces you to think about your own worldview. It forces you to think about your own underlying assumptions. So it hopefully should be pretty helpful. Now, the real question is wealth creation good, or is it bad, or is it halfway in the middle? The Bible is more nuanced than other worldviews on this. The answer is none of the above. It's not good, it's not bad, it's not something in the middle. We'll see that. Interestingly enough, when you go to the Bible, you'll see that wealth creation and wealth itself is well thought of. And let me give you three or four theological, biblical reasons why being wealthy and enjoying the material creation, material pleasures, and making money and wealth creation is a good in the Bible. First of all, quickly, just to give you some basic planks here. First of all, the Bible has the Judeo-Christian worldview is more positive about the material world, about food and drink, about money, about nature, about the material world, than any other of the great religions. Now, that's a little bit, if you're a member of one of the great religions, you might say, "Now, wait a minute here." But I'm saying, consider these things. It's at least as good and probably better. First of all, Buddhism and Hinduism believe the material world's an illusion, and basically that when we get over the illusion, it won't be there. When it comes to the Western tradition, the Greek and the Roman worldview understood the material creation as something that is basically bad and the spirit is good. That's Hellenistic thought. If you go look at almost any of the old myths about or legends, whether they're Northern European or Near Eastern, about how the world was created, they're all very entertaining. But you ever notice, the world is never created deliberately. It's always created as a result of a huge battle, and somebody kills someone, and then they take the body and they make something, or they create a place where they can go have the gods can go have a good time. Only in the Bible do you have the idea that you have a deity, God, who makes the material world on purpose, and over and over and over and over and over and over again says it's good. And then on top of all that, even Islam thinks that our future is going to be an immaterial, non-material, heavenly place where we don't have bodies. But the Bible says that the goal of God is to renew the heavens and the earth, so even our future is going to be material. That we're going to eat and drink in the future. We're going to have bodies in the future. Jesus Christ, his body is resurrected, and he says, this is what it's going to be like. Give me a fish. He eats the fish. It's a material future. What that means is the Bible gives no support to the idea that material deprivation is a good, is an ennobling thing, is something that just being poor and not having is necessarily something that ennobles you. No, pleasures, material pleasures are to be enjoyed. Here's another thing. When you look at the creation account, and God in the Bible creates Adam and Eve, he makes them gardeners. He has them tend a garden. And this is, again, unique. If you look at all the other creation accounts of any of the other religions or philosophies or cultures, you don't have anything like this. When God creates a garden, which is a natural resource, puts the human beings in there and says, make it productive. The very essence of what we're built to do, the very essence of what the Bible says is our relationship to the natural resource, the material universe, is we're not park rangers. Park rangers just sort of make sure it stays the way it is. They're gardeners. There's potentialities in the soil, there's potentialities, and the gardener's job is to make it productive. Or put it another way, if you give $1 million to a Brinks security man, his job is just to watch it and give it back. Exactly $1 million. That's his job. You give him $1 million, I'll watch it, I'll be careful with it, and you know, a month from now, I'll give it to you back. But if you give $1 million to a broker, you want to see it be productive. You want it to produce jobs. You want it to produce new products. You want it to produce all sorts of things. The essence of what God created us to be is to take resources, natural resources, undeveloped resources, and make them productive. And you know what this means? I mean, here's a maybe this is a slightly funny way to put it, is imagine the new heavens and new earth. In other words, the Christian understanding, the Judeo-Christian understanding of the future is not you're going to be in heaven in a sort of a non-material, ethereal world forever, but that God is going to renew this world so that it works right. It's not, we don't have disease, we don't have oppression, we don't have injustice, but it's still going to be a material world. And you know what this means? We're still going to need bankers. We're still going to need artists. We're still going to need musicians. Why? What does a musician do? A musician, a farmer, and a banker are all basically doing the same thing. We're taking something undeveloped, and we're pulling the potentialities of creation. And we're mining them. So, for example, there's new sounds. There's new music. Music's never been created. That God created, in a sense, the potential for that music when he made the world. And we haven't gotten to it yet. In the new heavens and new earth, there will be farmers. There will be bankers. There will be scientists and physicists, you know, people constantly studying and developing the natural world. And there's going to be artists. But there will not be ministers. There will not be counselors. There will not be social workers. There will not be doctors. In other words, we're the white corpuscles. You're the red corpuscles. We're only here because there's something wrong. I'll be out of a job. You won't be. Okay? And you say, how could, do you understand, from a Christian worldview, do you see how surprisingly positive wealth creation, material pleasure, productivity, brokering, taking undeveloped things and making them and developing them. Do you see how positive it is? It's remarkable. In fact, in some ways, it's probably more positive than the evolutionary idea. Because in naturalism, we only have, until the sun burns out and everything on the planet dies, you know, we might as well, we only go around once in life. We've got to grab for all the gusto we can. That's a beer commercial. Only people my age would know that. But that was what used to be said. But you see, the Christian understanding is considerably more positive toward material prosperity and wealth creation. Fortunately and unfortunately, I think it's mainly unfortunately, the power of money to corrupt you isn't generally that obvious. I mean, for most of us, it's not that obvious. At least it's not that obvious. It comes at you more subtly, but I say that's actually unfortunate. Let me talk to you a little bit about another world, another aspect of the Bible gives us another perspective on money. There's a sense in which the Bible does not fit any economic theory right now, any view of money at all that I can tell, because the Bible is incredibly positive about wealth creation and incredibly negative about wealth creation at the very, very same time. It is enormously positive about it in a way that more socialistic and centralized understandings of economic theory says we need to control, we need to stop capitalism, you know, big companies and wealthy people are the problem. It's considerably more positive than those folks, than that theory. But it's considerably more negative than people who are real major promoters of the free enterprise system. In other words, if somebody said, well, what is the Christian economic theory? It's really not something in the middle. It's not as positive or as negative. It's both positive, incredibly positive, and incredibly negative about wealth creation at the very same time. And as confusing as that might be, if you're writing a paper on economic theory, you know, for your MBA program, it's still profoundly wise and right. Because you see, money does have a power, as Hal Holbrook there said. I think that was that Hal Holbrook? Yeah. As he said, trouble with money is it makes you do things you don't want to do. Now let's get back to that. But there's no doubt you can build your identity on anything and you can make anything an idol. But the fact is that when you do your very first deal and you suddenly make 10 times more money than you've ever made in your life, you can sense that there's a greater kind of spiritual energy going on there than if you if you do your if you're a doctor and you do your first operation. I mean, I'm sure there's a high after you've done your first operation. Hey, I can do this. It's not the same. There's a negative spiritual energy, you know, to make, maybe I'm using a kind of new agey, but it's a perfectly biblical understanding too, that there's a negative spiritual energy in money. So for example, when Jesus talks to the woman at the well in John 4, he talks to her about her sex life. He talks to her about her relationships with men. Doesn't say a thing to her about money. But when he talks to the rich young ruler in Mark chapter 10 and a number of other places, it's one of the it's in every one of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He says, if you want to follow me, you have to give up everything. You have to give all your money away, give it all away to the poor and follow me. Now, he never does that to anybody else. He doesn't say that to anyone else. And so some people have been trying to say, well, what's going on there? Does it really mean you have to be poor to be a Christian, a disciple of Jesus? No, what he's really saying is money has such a negative spiritual power that if you are making it, if you are using it, if you are around it, you need to realize that you've got to put some sort of lead wall around it. You really have to be very careful with it. It can make you do things you don't want to do. It can make you be somebody that you really don't really want to be, and yet it has that kind of power. What kind of power? Basically, in the garden, we were given the garden, right, to tend. But that meant that it was God's wealth that we were to broker. We're supposed to make it productive, but it's not our wealth, it's God's wealth. The real problem is that the sin in the heart, according to the Bible, takes your money and makes you think of it as yours. The money is mine. See, if it's God's money, the biblical understanding is the money you make is not yours. That's the individualistic approach. It's not the state's. That's the socialistic approach. And it's not your family's. That's the more traditional approach. It's God's. And if that's the case, then there are multiple bottom lines in business. That is to say, profit is definitely a bottom line, but it's not the only bottom line. The good of the community in which the company works, your own family being strengthened, jobs for people. There's a whole lot of other bottom lines besides profit. If you understand the way the Bible says in Genesis 1 and 2, we should be looking at the wealth. The wealth isn't yours. It's not the individuals. It's not the states. It's not your families. It belongs to God, and God has all those concerns. Now, what does that mean? If you make money the bottom line in your life, if it becomes more important than anything else, if it becomes the way you feel good about yourself, that you're making money, if the status that comes from it makes you feel like, now I know I'm really somebody significant, and you know that's what happens, you know it. Here's some of the things that can go wrong in your life. Number one, let me just have a little list here. Number one, it means staying in a job. Very often you'll stay in a job that makes money, but you know is not really helping anybody, and you know it doesn't really fit in on your own gifts. In other words, you'll stay in very unfulfilling jobs that really doesn't grow you, and it really doesn't help anybody else. But the job makes you money. And if you stay in a job like that, it's brutalizing, and it's hardening. But a lot of folks say, but I could never make anything like this kind of money anywhere else, so you stay there, which means money has become the bottom line, the ultimate bottom line, the only bottom line. It should be one of many, you know, equal bottom lines in your life, but it becomes the bottom line. So you find yourself staying in jobs that really you shouldn't be in, but it makes you money. Here's a second problem. You will overwork. You'll overwork. You know, in the Old Testament, you had the Sabbath law, which was you deliberately diminished your profits by not working one day a week. There was no other culture, by the way, than the Jews who did that. You couldn't even work slaves on the last day, on that seventh day. And so what really was happening there was God was saying, I want you to deliberately diminish the profits for the sake of mental health, for your physical health, for your family health, and all that sort of thing. Multiple bottom lines. If money becomes the main bottom line for you, the main way in which you feel secure about the world instead of looking to God, the main way you feel like you can handle worry, the main way you feel significant. That's the second problem. So first of all, you'll stay in jobs that don't fulfill you. Secondly, you'll overwork. Thirdly, now I'll be careful how I say this because I'm a sort of a, being a minister, I do counseling too. it'll make you bipolar about money. Now, I mean, what is bipolar? As you know, there's a true bipolar disorder, which is a kind of, it's a psychiatric, it's a physiological disorder. And in bipolar disorder, normal highs get jacked up into irrational exuberance. I know, that's what, I know, isn't that what Greenspan talks about? Yes, that's right. Well, there's something to this. Now listen carefully. Irrational exuberance, a person who's got a bipolar depression, a bipolar condition, when he or she actually starts, has a, what you and I would call a normal good mood, it gets jacked up. It gets unrealistic euphoria, unrealistic expectations, overconfidence, trying to do things you really can't do. On the other hand, in bipolar disorder, when you have a bad mood, you get into absolute suicidal despondency and despair. Now, this is what happens if money is too important in your life, and you let it exert that negative spiritual energy. It's bipolar, for example. On the one hand, I guess you know too, but one of the most interesting things is people who make a lot of money and are pretty successful in life are unrealistically confident that they are therefore good in all kinds of other areas. You know that. It's actually somewhat embarrassing. They feel like they know everything about religion. They feel like they know everything about acting. They feel they know everything about art. And they really truly do. Because what's happened is that it's bipolar. And you actually are very unrealistic about how you're going to deal with people, how you can deal in relationships, how you deal with the rest of your life. On the other hand, if you have an economic failure, or if you stop making as much money, or as if you suddenly move into a lower income bracket, it's not just like, well, gee, I guess I can't go on the vacations I used to go on. It's like, who am I? Who am I? I don't have an identity left. You're bipolar. Way too euphoric when things go well financially, way too despondent when things don't go well. Fourth, it'll make you seal off your business life from the rest of your kind of life, because in the rest of your life, you do have multiple bottom lines. For example, a lot of you, you'll live in a place that actually isn't the best buy, it's not the best deal, but you like the community. In fact, if you really, really wanted to save more money, if you really wanted to be more economically efficient, you'd move someplace, or you'd sell that thing and buy something else, but you don't. Why? Because you value the community, you value the people around you. Maybe your spouse likes certain things, and you're so happy to have him or her have those things, even though it was a really lousy buy. In other words, because of relationships, because of common good, because of community, maybe you'll patronize a particular proprietor just because you know them, their family, even though you could definitely get a better deal, you could definitely buy that for less somewhere else. In other words, in your personal life, you're balanced. But as soon as you get into your business life, suddenly profit is, that's it. It's not the character of the workers. It's not whether or not this product is really helping people. It's not the social fabric. You know, business is business. I'm producing a cultural product that's bad for people. I kind of know that, but business is business. So what happens is you become a hypocrite. You become, in fact, if you can seal off the way you live in business and the way you deal with people, very, very ruthless, very cutthroat, very, very competitive, in the rest of your life you're different, but in business, it's going to seep out into the rest of your life. It will. Or else, you will find that you become a person who's got two personalities, you're not really sure who you are. So for all these reasons, money is a tremendously negative spiritual power, and therefore the Bible actually says, you know, when Jesus talks about mammon, you know what mammon is? You've heard the term mammon. It's actually an Egyptian god. And Jesus was actually saying that money, he doesn't say that about most other kinds of jobs, money can become a kind of spiritual god in your life unless you find all sorts of ways of dealing with it. So money's good. Wealth creation is good. Wealth creation is also an incredibly dangerous thing that you need to not look at as an undiluted good. Make as much as I can any way I want as long as it's legal. But you have to ask yourself the question, how do I make sure that money has redemptive purposes in my life and in the life of the people around me? Now, that's the last thing we're going to look at. We talked about money, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Let's talk about, is there a way for us to use the Christian worldview to affect the way in which we actually do our business life and the way in which we actually do wealth creation? So if all your competitors go to one bottom line, then everybody has to go or else you're out of business. When all the businesses used multiple bottom lines to some degree, when they were very slow to do layoffs and they tended to hold on to They were loyal to employees that had been loyal to them. When the entire environment was like that, then you could get away with it and still make a profit. But when some of your competitors go into the kinds of policies where no one's loyal to anyone, as soon as something stops producing, within weeks it has to be cut off and taken out. If your competitors do that, you in a sense have to do it too, and therefore money is a kind of system, and it's a combination of the shareholders and the other employees and the other competitors that push you more and more into a position where the bottom line is the only thing. Now, what could you do as a Christian in that environment? Let me just suggest two things. The first thing, and I would rather you ask me questions at this point, and we're going to have time in about 5 minutes for the questions. And maybe you could give me some examples, and I could try to apply the principles I've given you tonight. But it's going to take accumulated wisdom for Christians to say, I want to become, I think Catherine, this was Catherine's term, I want Christians to become thought leaders in how to value other bottom lines besides profit, equal bottom lines. Profit is one of the reasons you're in business. But there are other bottom lines, like the environment, worker flourishing, the flourishing of your employees, like justice and fair play that goes beyond the legal. I mean, there's obviously certain things that are illegal, but there's also justice and fair play inside your firm that if you do it, you may not make as much of a profit. I mean, there are ways to treat employees and coworkers that aren't illegal, but they're inequitable. You know that you'd probably do better if you just marginalize that person, cut that person off, cut that person right out. There's all sorts of ways of doing that. You're not going to make as much money if you treat that person fairly, but that's a bottom line in the Christian worldview. And ultimately, if justice and equity and integrity, if the common good of the community, if the environment, if worker flourishing, if all those things are equal bottom lines with profit, you're not going to make as much money in the short run. You may make more money in the long run because there's a cutthroat competition, destroying your employees' morale. That can bite you back. But I don't think a Christian says, like I think they say at most law schools, it will help you maximize profits if you help employee morale. Christianity would say that employee flourishing is an equal good and a sort of end in itself, along with profit, you see. It's not a means to an end of profit. If all the things you do, you say, well, of course we're going to help the environment. Of course we're going to do community service. Of course, we're going to try to help workers flourish because it's good business. If you say that, you're into a naturalistic worldview, not the Christian worldview. And ultimately, I'm not sure you actually will be all that helpful to the environment, to the community, to your employees. If all of those things, those other bottom lines, are ends in themselves and yet equal, they can't destroy your profits. There has to be a balance. How do you do that? Christians have to work that out. Christians have to show how that can be. It's likely when you are new in a big company that you're many, many ways going to have to just earn your spurs and to a great degree often find yourself being pushed beyond where you could be, where you're completely comfortable as a Christian, not doing anything illegal, not doing anything immoral, but clearly being pushed in an environment where you can see that there's only one bottom line. But as you get up the ladder, it's one of the reasons to stay in the financial services industry, instead of just, you know, making some money and getting out, is as you get up the ladder, there are probably ways for you to work out how do we value other bottom lines besides profit and still do good business and not make these other bottom lines just means to an end, but really bottom lines, multiple bottom lines. That's the question. And now let me give you a quick example of one. I don't know if he's here, and you may have heard the story because he goes to Redeemer, but I'm not going to use his name just not to embarrass him. There was a man who was working in a financial services, I'll just say, a firm, and there was a company that the firm was going to work with that this particular man, as a Christian, felt well, not just as a Christian, but the man says, I don't want to work with this company because I don't think this company, the way this company makes its money is not good in all sorts of ways. It doesn't value community, doesn't value the social fabric. Who knows? Maybe it was MTV. I'm not sure. But let's just say it was something like that. So what this man said was to the rest of his coworkers, I vote against you working with this company. But everyone else voted against him because their company can make quite a bit of money working on that with this company. So what this man did was he said, if I lose the vote, here's what I'm going to do. On the one hand, I will work as hard as anybody else on putting the deal together. But on the other, I will work as hard, if not harder, than everyone else. However, I will get none of the profits from it. In other words, when the deal comes through, and I'm working with six other guys on it, the other five can divide up the profits. I don't want one cent. I vote against it. I don't think it's a good idea. But I also know that I lost the vote. Now, you see, a Pharisaical attitude, not a Christian attitude, not a sinner saved by grace attitude, but a Pharisaical moralistic attitude probably would have been to quit the firm. Or maybe even to try to trash the deal, or maybe to undermine or create a very hostile environment. He didn't do that. On the other hand, the other deal would be say, well, I lost the vote, or maybe just not even said anything at all. How do you think his coworkers look at him now? A little nuts? Yeah, but they also, there's an admiration. They don't completely understand it. There's an admiration. Is he going to actually probably grow in his moral influence and authority inside the church, inside the firm? Yeah. What he has just done was he showed, even though he was a man in a firm that's operated with only one bottom line, he exhibited a desire to go in another direction, and to some degree, he was able to do it and still keep his conscience clear, and was able to do it in a way that other people admired. Now, you say, well, okay, that's an interesting case study. We need about 1,000 case studies like that. We need to share them with each other as Christian believers till we can accumulate the wisdom. We can share it with each other and say, here are all the kinds of ways in which you can value multiple bottom lines in your job and still do good business and still do well and still make your firm feel like you're not undermining what they're trying to do. It's got to happen. What I'm going to do at this point is take questions, because I think that will be more important than if I keep on rambling, because the principles are not too hard to see. But once we, if you ask me back, I mean, you can always ask me back. If you say, okay, that was interesting, the principles are interesting, but we want more practicalities on how to do that. That isn't the sort of thing you're going to that happens with 300 people in a room listening to a preacher or a theologian. In fact, or anyone. This is where you're going to have to find the time to get together. Take the Christian worldview, those of you who believe it, and sit down and say, we got to figure out some ways of working this out. How do we do this in a way? How do we do this? How do we value multiple bottom lines in an environment that doesn't? Where the system is pushing us away from it. How can we do it with integrity? How can we do it with creativity? How can we do it with so that our coworkers trust us? In fact, trust us maybe even more than other coworkers. And yet we still are able to show them a sort of a different way of valuing of values, a different way of working. How do we do that? You've got to do that together. You've got to do that maybe with ministers or with people who, you know, maybe know the Bible. But the trouble is, I know the Bible. I don't know your world that well. You know your world. You may not know the Bible as well as me. We have to get together. Christians have to get together, and we can create that kind of accumulated wisdom. And there might be, you might have to start some companies that actually, in a more pure way, operate like this. Doesn't mean, that's not the same thing as a Christian company, by the way. That's not necessarily a company that says, we're Christians, so we do Bible studies at our company. We're Christians, so we invest in overtly Christian, other Christian companies. That's not what a Christian company is, though I suppose there's no reason why you couldn't do that if you wanted to. A Christian company isn't a Christian company per se. It's a company operating out of a Christian worldview. It doesn't have to say it's overtly Christian. It certainly doesn't have to only hire Christians by any means. And therefore, I think that is not the kind of thing that most, that I see out there yet, and we have to develop, especially in a place like New York. Okay, listen, up to now I've been telling you things that I really believe they're in the Bible. I can talk to you about the fact that you have to understand the material world as a good. You don't look at it as an evil. You have to understand the spiritual power of money. Okay, now that I'm starting to answer questions like this, these are just my opinions. Can you make that distinction? Just because I'm the minister, I'm not preaching the word at this point. I'm just giving you my opinion. So it might be, I could certainly be wrong on this. I'd love to see companies operating out of a Christian worldview. I know that there are non-Christians that find that attractive, find the Christian worldview attractive. They sense, yes, money actually does have a negative spiritual energy. It really does have an enslaving power. Also, on the other hand, it is basically a good thing. I do like the idea of multiple bottom lines that are equal, that we don't have to choose between them. I don't know why, in that case, if you had a company like that, that would really be doing an awful lot of good for people, worker flourishing community. Why only have Christians in it? It would seem to me that a Christian attitude would be, if this is really going to be a great place to work. I mean, I made a little list. A company like this, I made a little list here. A company operating on this principle would be, outside the company, would probably look fairly well run. It might not, by the way, make more money than any of its competitors. It probably wouldn't. It might. But inside, there would be a noticeable lack of adversarial relationships, a lack of any sense of being exploited on the part of anybody, an extremely strong emphasis on product quality, an ethical environment that goes all the way down, even when high ethics means some loss of money. In other words, there's an awful lot of people who would like to be part of that. Number one, so why? Why confine it? You know, why say only Christians can be in it? Secondly, as soon as you get outside of the church environment, it's mighty hard to define a Christian. I mean, you know, here we have a Presbyterian church, and if somebody wants to join the church, we sit down, we ask a series of questions, doctrinal questions, questions about, you know, your beliefs and so on. Even so, when you have a person join a church, they say, I'm a Christian. To some degree, you know, you have to take their word for it. But at least churches have some. How are you going to define it? I mean, what you're going to have a doctrinal? You're going to have a doctrinal, statement or something like that? I would, in general, feel that it's not a great idea to try to create Christian companies that have Christians in most of the positions, but rather create companies with a sets of values that reflect the Christian worldview, and then let everyone come who wants to be part of that. Therefore, I'm not excited about the idea of the Christian companies. And the ones that I have read about, it's been tough. It's been tough for the people who are part of the company who aren't Christians not to feel really like fish out of water and really looked down upon in some ways. It wouldn't be that easy if you create that kind of over a Christian environment. So let's keep going. The question is, why would money seem to have all that spiritual enslaving power more than so many other things? Well, you know, one theory, I don't know. I mean, one of the theories is that that there's a fine line between stewardship and ownership, that we were made to be stewards. In other words, we were made to take charge of things. But what sin has done is it pushes us over from stewards into owners and makes us want to be completely in control. In other words, the way in which the average person, including me, actually, we're all embezzlers. That is, you know, so I've been given my talent, I've been given my abilities, I've been given my family, the education they gave me, I've been given all this stuff, and instead of saying, this is all yours, God, I basically take credit for it. I say, hey, I'm smart. You know, I've got all these degrees, and I'm pretty smart, and I've read all these books, and I walk around thinking I'm pretty smart. Now, there's a sense in which my education and my memory, I've got a good memory, it's not that hard for me to take all these good assets and start taking credit for them, build my identity on them. It makes me kind of self-righteous, it makes me pharisaical, it makes me narrow-minded. Nevertheless, I'm not totally sure why money is. I would just say probably that since God made us to be brokers and made us to be stewards, it's just so close between that and it's such a small step from stewardship to ownership. You know, for example, God gave Adam and Eve the whole garden except for one thing, remember? In other words, they were allowed ownership of everything in a sense, but the one reason that they, when God says, don't eat of that tree, it was almost a reminder of saying, the garden really isn't yours, it's mine. And because the garden isn't, if it was yours, you could do anything you wanted with it. But I'm going to say, don't eat that tree, just to remind you that you're stewards, not owners. Most theologians believe that there was absolutely nothing. There wasn't like sin juice in the tree or something like that. Like, and when they ate the tree, that somehow there was something in the tree. No, it was the principle. The principle was, I want you to see that the garden, you are just stewards, you're not owners, and the garden's not yours, and I'm the owner. And you need to be using all this wealth I'm giving you. Think about it. Paradise for me. And Adam and Eve didn't want to do that. And so when they did that, it seems like, therefore, ownership of wealth and resources has ever since then been particularly cursed. I know I've read people talking about that, but that still doesn't completely explain it. But there's a little bit of theological background for you. Yeah, okay, that's a great question, too. The New York Times always likes to point out that some of the people who have been found guilty of some of the scandals, it's like at Enron, especially, were professing Christians. They love to point that out, people who, you know, went to evangelical churches and that sort of thing. If something that's already being done that's illegal, it would be in your best interest to be a whistleblower, I think. I mean, you wouldn't... There's two reasons to be a whistleblower if something is grossly illegal and you know about it. The one would be you do it for God's sake. But there's another reason, and the reason you might as well do it for your sake. It's a way. It's almost in your best interest. It might blow up the company. It might mean you'll never work in this town again. You know, there's other towns, and you'd probably and at least you. It's very hard to get another job if you're in jail. Very difficult. You know, they say, well, why can't you come in for your interview while I'm in jail? Well, that kind of puts you at the end of the line. Yeah. See. So, but I think. You indicated that there's another level, and that is things that you see where you need reform. There's another form. It's not whistleblowing. It's sort of critique. Say, this isn't the right way to do this. I mean, maybe right. Maybe it's illegal. Maybe it's not illegal. But we need to take responsibility for the havoc this is going to wreak in people's lives. I would say it's easy for me to say I'm not in your world, is that you should stand up for that. But, boy, there are bad ways to do it. There are remarkably, you know, the reason I gave you the example of the brother, friend of mine, who was able to have the integrity to vote no and still support, you know, on that particular company and still support his firm. He said, I'm going to work hard on it, but I'm not going to take any of the profits from it. That was it was a compromise. It was wonderful. But notice, it wasn't self-righteous. It wasn't... He didn't undermine the idea and say, look, you guys voted for it. I say, you can work on it. I'm not even going to have anything to do with it. He didn't do that. So you've got to find ways that are not self-righteous, not unusually hostile, you know, ways that don't completely blindside people. But I still think, yes, we do need to do that, where you say, you know, this is wreaking havoc. You know, this is, again, not in the money world. But did you see the article in the New York Times Magazine 2 weeks ago about the kids that create the incredibly bad computer viruses? Did you see that article? Basically, what they do is they create the virus that they know could wreak billions of dollars of damage, and they don't actually put it anywhere. They just put it out on the web. And they say, I'm an artist, and I like to do it just to be able to do it, just to know I can do it. And if other people, I'm not responsible for how people use it. And what was interesting was the following week there were all these letters written in, angry letters saying these kids don't know what they're doing, they're putting people out of jobs, they're maybe killing people because, you know, computer viruses screwing up computers in some systems might actually lead to people dying, especially in the, you know, medical systems and hospitals and so on. And they said what they're doing is not illegal, but it's absolutely immoral. Now, I'm thinking about C.S. Lewis's book, The Abolition of Man. But when I read those letters, I said, the abolition of man, because there's a place, a famous place where C.S. Lewis says, we live in a culture that says everything is relative. And then we're really, you know, he says, we make fun of honor, and then we are shocked at traitors in our midst. And there's a place where he says, we castrate the geldings and then bid them be fruitful. You know, it's a very vivid metaphor. And there's no doubt when I look at these kids, you know, you can see that they come in an environment where they say, well, if it's not illegal, what's wrong with it? But I think we have a worldview that says, yeah, this is wreaking havoc. It's hurting. this constituency, whether it's the employees, whether it's misrepresenting, but it's not illegal. I do think Christians ought to do that. I wouldn't call that whistleblowing. It makes you a reformer. Again, it's a little hard. I'm looking out there at your. For many of you, it's a little hard at your age. I would say the older you get, guys, men and women, the older you get, and the further up you get, the more I think God would hold you responsible to say something. And the further on, first of all, the further on down, you don't even see it, or you can't be totally sure you got it straight. But I do think that that's part of our witness. Yeah, I do. Money makes you do things you don't want to do. There's a power and there's a system. Let me say a couple of things. In some ways, I will emote a little bit, but in a way, you're asking the question that I was posing to everybody here, which is to say, you actually do have to come together with a few folks, perhaps somebody like me, or some people who come with a little more theological resources, or a little more in the area of biblical knowledge than those of you who are in the field have. But together with those of you in the field, where you actually brainstorm. Because if you get eight of you together and you say, what do you do about this situation, one of the eight of you actually has an idea of how to respond in a way that probably is going to move the firm in the right direction, keeps your conscience clear, does it in an unself-righteous way. You've got to come together and do it. I mean, you really do. And I don't, I mean, one of our jobs at Redeemer, and you don't know how, the minute, I'm hoping the financial services, I shouldn't say this since you guys are here and Catherine's here, but one of the things we have to do is we have to find ways of accumulating that wisdom and retaining it and passing it on to people. That's all I can tell you. But you're right about the frog in the kettle thing. There's no doubt that 20 years ago, their business practices that 20 years ago people just would never have even thought about doing. They said, well, that's just too cutthroat. That's just too harsh. I mean, you can't do that. And now we do it. Pat Moynihan called it defining deviancy down when he mentioned that when he was growing up in Hell's Kitchen, when there were more people in Manhattan than there are now, there were 44 murders a year in the late 40s in Manhattan. And I know that before Giuliani came in, there was something like, what, how many? It was like 1,800, and it went below 1,000. Everybody said, look how great it is. And Moynihan sat there and said, how did we get to the place where when you had 2 million people living in Manhattan, we had 44 murders a year, and now we have 1.6 million people living in Manhattan, we're down to 1,000. That's still more than 20 times. What happened? And the answer is, it happened slowly. And if it had happened overnight, we would have said, stop everything, we can't do it. Same thing. Something like that's happened in the business world. It's been very, very, very slow. And yet there's got to be ways of standing up, I think, inside. But I tell you, I can't do it as a preacher telling you, well, here's 18 case studies. Another way to put it is, one more thing. I know this because I got one of my sons is in your world, is the busyness of your world keeps you apart. I mean, you're not able to get together. How do you get together? When do you have the time? You're just barely keeping your nose above water. You're always working very, very hard. When do you get a time to sit down and reflect? You do not have a business in which you can reflect. Artists do get together and reflect. Ministers get together and reflect. Even from what I can tell, doctors and nurses and that sort of thing tend to get together and reflect. You know, they get together and they have case studies and they discuss. There's sort of education very often going on, at least in a big city. Hospitals and that sort of thing. You're not allowed to, but you have to find time to do that. You have to find ways of getting together, especially with other Christians in your field, and not just having a Bible study in which you support each other, hold each other's hands, and say, you know, hold on, I'm sure you can survive. I survived. I mean, that you do need that. You do need that. You know, how do I? You're always scared. You're always overworked. You're always kind of sinking. And there's a tendency if you get together, is just to sort of help each other emotionally and spiritually. But you have to reflect. And get on down and say, how do we work these values into our lives? You know, how do we choose jobs and careers that promote the common good? How do we work with, how do we practice the honor and integrity? You know, so not cutting corners in a way that benefits you, but not other employees, customers, or companies. How do you, that sort of thing. Anyway, yes, sorry. I'm answering a question that actually has to be answered by you. So give me a question I might be able to answer. would there be a possibility that you, as a Christian believer, say, well, you know, they screwed up. So in other words, it's a hard world, and in fact, there are definitely ways in which you make money off of competitors' problems all the time, right? I mean, they screw up. You knew they screwed up. They blew it, and now you are going to take them to the cleaners. They might even lose their shirts because you're going to make a deal. So I would think there's a possibility that a Christian could say, and I'd have to be in much closer. I'd need to have more information, and I'd actually want the advice of a couple of Christian people in business who've been through this before, including, in other words, I'm trying to make this case for community. If I were you, I actually would have a community of people to ask that question to, who you knew would love you, care for you, and support you no matter what you did, because they know this is all a gray area. There's a wonderful place in our Westminster Confession. That's the old Presbyterian Confession, drafted in the 17th century. And there's a chapter called Liberty of Conscience. And Liberty of Conscience says, where the Bible has not bound your conscience, you must not try to bind somebody's conscience. So there's nothing in the Bible that says exactly what you need to do there. And therefore, if you had some Christian brothers and sisters, a couple of whom might have, you know, might be in ministry, a couple of whom might have a lot of experience in business that you could ask the question to, say, what do you think? Take a poll. Then you could feel like, I've really been doing my Christian duty here, because I'm asking God's, this is the main way you ask God's guidance in something like this. I could see that somebody could make a case for saying, this is a place where they screwed up, and therefore we are not actually going to do anything illegal, right? You said you can stick with it, not the spirit, the illegal, and this is really just playing it hard. You could go either way. I would rather be in a group of people trying to make that decision, praying about it, thinking about it with you, that then you were saying, now I'm going to make this choice, and if you don't like what I'm doing, I've heard you all out, and now I really think the Lord has given me some direction here. Will you support me and be good to me and respect me no matter, even if I don't take your advice? And if you have wise people around you, they'll say, fine. Some Christians might say, I'm just not going to do this. I'm going to resign. The gleaning principle in the Old Testament was you were not allowed to maximize your profits. I mean, Andrew Carnegie's approach is, I glean all the way out to the edges of my fields, and then I will give to the poor people. And God said, no, you can't. There's a principle there that said, you don't make as much money as you possibly can, because actually, because you actually are you're disempowering people by saying, I'm going to take it all, and then I will give it to you, which means you're in complete control of it. You're in control of who's getting it. There's the Jubilee principle, the Sabbath principle, the gleaning principle actually diminish your profits somewhat. I think you could, what you can't say is the profit is a means to some other end. Like, I mean, the profit has to be a bottom line, and you can't let the other bottom line squeeze it out, but you can't let the bottom line squeeze it out. I think there's probably a way to create more tension than right now you would like to see, but that's one of the reasons why we're here tonight. I'm challenging you, you're challenging me a little. So I think you can talk about multiple bottom lines anyway. And there are people who might take a different approach on it. But if I were you, I would try to create some community around you to answer some questions like that and not think it's just a given. Okay, a couple more. Yes, go ahead. How do you recognize when you're rationalizing something? Yep. When you're talking about a contract done poorly, so in a certain sense, they just didn't do their job. And I can legally go with it, stick with it, and yet not go with the spirit of it and save money. The reason I don't think that's an open and shut case. I don't think that's like, well, the integrity means you should follow the spirit of it. You know, persons and individuals, it's a little different. I mean, I think there's a possibility, he may be right, that may be the way to go. But it's not infinitely flexible, because here you have Andrew Carnegie, and you're right, Andrew Carnegie's the way he treated his workers, the terrible working conditions in which they were, people died. I forget what my wife's from Pittsburgh, so I know something about the history of Pittsburgh, and you know the life expectancy of Andrew Carnegie's workers was just terrible. So he maximized his profits literally out of their hide, and then he made, you know, gave it back to the world by putting up all those libraries, etc., which of course glorifies him. He's in control of that money. Instead of giving the money, instead of giving some of that money to the workers so they could do with it as they pleased, he was taking it from them, and then he was in control of where that money was going. He knew he was rationalizing, by the way. There's some pretty famous, when he was like 35, he wrote himself a letter saying, I've got to get out of business. It's degrading me. It's dehumanizing me. Have you ever seen that? Some of you? And he couldn't stop. The real problem is that when you get up high enough, there is nobody to hold you accountable. And there's just, that's the reason why, well, it's, the example I used in an old sermon some years ago was First Congregational Church, well, they were all kind of, First Church of Boston, 1640, disciplined, excommunicated one of its members for greed. Did you know that? That doesn't happen much. People get excommunicated for adultery, for heresy, for a number of things, maybe even embezzling, but they don't get excommunicated for greed. And what they had decided was, as a community, they said, you know what? Let's just decide that nobody can make more than 5% profit on what. In other words, you can't, your profits on things can only be 5%. Otherwise, you're gouging people. Now, I know a lot of us think that's ridiculous. But anyway, this what they did was this church decided that if any of their people in business were making more than 5% profit on their products, then they would be guilty of greed. And when he went over that, they disciplined him. That's a historic record. Now, you say, well, that's really legalistic, and it might be, but here's the question. Nobody ever thinks they're guilty of greed. That's the frog in the kettle thing that our friend was saying. Nobody ever thinks they're guilty of greed, practically. It's almost impossible. And the reason is because if you get to this level, you're always at clubs, or you're rubbing shoulders with people who are at the next level. If you get into this level, you're always rubbing shoulders with people who are just above you. So you just do not feel wealthy. No matter how much you have, you never feel wealthy. And therefore, unless you have a community which looks at one another and says, no one will ever be guilty of greed. Nobody will ever. At least with adultery, you kind of know. You know, you kind of know whether you've had sex or something. I mean, you kind of know. I mean, I know that even there, people like to fudge. But basically, you can tell, you know, that we had some kind of, there was some kind of sexual experience there. But greed, you never know. You never know. So unless you're willing to find some other people who you let in on some of your business decisions, you let in even on your lifestyle. If you're not willing to do that, you have swallowed the Western naturalistic individualism hook, line, and sinker. And you may say, you may be a Christian in your beliefs, but you've sealed off your Christian worldview for the way in which you live. So you're absolutely right about rationalization. You've got to have some other people. And perhaps maybe you need a person inside and a couple people outside. Because almost everybody on the inside of the business world tends to have a little bit of that frog in the kettle thing, too. It should be a small group, people that you go to, that you ask questions about. I bet you very few of you have that. I mean, it's very, I'm not saying, well, bad on you. I'm just saying that we don't do it that way. And you're so busy, you have no time to put together a group like that. I've been talking about wealth creation working inside your business. Now, tithing is something that you personally, it's a personal lifestyle issue to say, no matter how much I make, I'm going to give at least 10% away to God's work, to charity, to the poor, and that sort of thing. I wouldn't consider that one of the bottom lines, because that's not something you're doing. That's a personal, private decision. In your line of work, I mean, for most people, a tithe is a stretch. In your line of work, the tithe probably should be a bottom. That is to say, here's the reason why. If you make six figures, you make seven figures, and you find it hard to tithe, then what you've done is you just simply raised your lifestyle up way past where it should be. Because there's so much good you could be doing with your money, just an enormous amount of good. And I think it's probably true that for the average person who stays in the financial services, I'm not talking about your first year in it, but average person who stays in financial services, you ought to think of the tithe as a floor, as the beginning of the way in which you give your money away. Because you're absolutely right. People who make quite a bit of money, you can give 10% away and still be unbelievably selfish and exploitative with your money. Now am I getting at what you're saying? If you're really in debt, should you still be trying to give to your charity and the Lord and that sort of thing? Well, here is a multiple. If you... I think it's more important to get rid of your debt, but you have to be careful not to use. I mean, there's three things here. You have the way you live, how many restaurants you go to, what you do on vacation. You have your debt, and you have your benevolence. Okay, you mustn't say, "Oh, look how big my debt is. I can't do my benevolence." Let it cut into your lifestyle and get rid of your debt, and do your benevolence. But if it, in the bottom line is you have obligations to people, I would say if you can't tithe and still get rid of your debts, get rid of your debts. And then when your debts are done, tithe. I know there's some people who say, oh, no, you can't do that. It's God's money. Well, don't forget, God, it's all God's money, all of it. And one of the things he says is in Romans 12 is, owe no one anything, which means if you have a debt, get rid of your debt as fast as you can. And that's doing God's will. Okay? Okay. You can't serve God and money and mammon. That's in Luke 16 and other places. You could serve God and still make money. I think that's something that make a lot of money, quite a bit of money, and be very, very busy. I mean, Abraham, Job, Joseph of Arimathea, of course. There's quite a few people in the Bible who are not only wealthy, but there's no indication that there's something intrinsically wrong with being wealthy. So to make a lot of money and to work hard to make money doesn't necessarily mean you're not serving God. If the money makes you act in inequitable ways, act in ways that aren't quite, you know, in other words, if you're compromising integrity, compromising justice, if you're harming the social fabric, harming the environment, if you're exploiting your workers, you know, and you say, well, those are all hard because sometimes I'm pushing against it. Right. If you were serving God and not money, you wouldn't let the bottom line push you into compromising in all those areas. And if you are serving God, that won't be a problem. The fact is that you're right in saying that all of us are kind of in the middle. I'm in the middle. Look, why am I supposed to be preaching? Am I supposed to be preaching so people come and say, boy, you're smart and good? Or am I preaching for my glory or for God's glory? Class? Well, I'm in the middle. And I'm working like crazy to make it God's glory. And yet sometimes I'll see if somebody criticizes me, I'll be much more downcast than I ought to be. I say, I really blew that. I could have preached that so much better. And after 2 days of saying, I just really screwed up on that sermon, my wife says, now, wait a minute, why are you that upset? And the answer is, I'm in the middle. So it's not like, I mean, I've got, you know, I'm preaching for God's glory, preaching for my glory. You're supposed to be serving God, not mammon. Of course we're in the middle. But there's no reason why you still can't serve God and still make a lot of money and work hard doing it. You have to look for these other telltale signs. That's why I was suggesting these other lines, these other bottom lines. Make sure you don't let the one just completely screw you up in the other areas. I spoke this when I said that the company has a life of its own. And in publicly owned companies, which is what most of you are working for, nobody's really in charge. This is what the Bible talks about. The Bible talks about powers and principalities, and it's not just talking about demons. It's trying to say, oh, I don't know. Well, actually, you know what? My friend, by the way, I am not trying to make a case that MTV is bad for the social fabric, but I was trying to say that this particular man believed it was, and he was still making business. My friend decided he thought it was also bad for the social fabric, and until he talked to this guy, he felt that if he got up higher as a Christian in MTV, he could have an influence. And he came to realize that probably wasn't possible because there isn't anybody who could pull the plug on MTV, not when you're talking about billions and billions of dollars and all the stockholders. And there would be no one place. You see, who's in charge? It's a system. And if anybody did something that started to make it less marketable or hurt the profits in some ways, it wouldn't be any one person who would say, let's kill the social fabric. It's not like that. It's a system. Now, when you get into a large system like that, you're right. You are not hired to have the... You can't really, as an individual cog in that whole system, all by yourself say, well, it's the job of my particular firm to care about the environment. So I'm just not going to make... Or care about integrity, so I'm not going to go through this loophole. You can't do that because that's not what they charge you for. I gave you that illustration of this one guy who, in a place where his conscience was really hurt, he says, I'm going to be part of the team and I'm going to do my job, but I'm not going to take the profits from it. That was a way, that's a creative way to say, I know I can't just force the whole company to have my values, but I don't want to completely live according to the company's values either. That's what I'm asking you to find yourself ways to come together and think about. Because there are, I think, creative ways of doing it. I think you're right. In this case, he can't say to the company, well, you should care about integrity. But on the other hand, I know enough. I have the sight lines right to him. He, as he said, this is not infinitely flexible. He himself, he's got a conscience. There's certain things that he wouldn't do. And everybody knows that. The real question is, where are those lines going to be? And as soon as you admit that there are those lines there, then you already agree, in theory, with my idea that there's multiple bottom lines. This question is, where does it come in? And he was just asking me that question. Is this one of them? And I said, maybe, maybe not. But it doesn't have to be. As a minister, even, I would see, you know, if there's no, you're being legal, maybe that's the best thing to do. I don't know enough to go. I don't know enough about the situation to even give a real personal feeling that this would be the better thing than that. But there must be some ways sometimes to stick to your own values, even though your company did not hire you to change its values and does not have the same values. And that's really, really, really hard. Perhaps that's not the place to stand up. But there's some other places maybe where you could stand up and do it in a way that supports the company and does not just in a pharisaical way, you know, say, well, this whole company should be caring more. Now, if you see something systemic, I think one of the early questions was, if you see a systemic kind of bad policy that's wreaking havoc in somebody's lives, you might want to try to be a reformer. I don't know whether you can do that or not. You might have to lose your job if you try. But those are, it's a possibility that could be a good witness for you to say, firms do this, this is a bad practice, I'm not going to go along with it, I'm going to stand up against it. It might mean to complain about it makes you lose your job. That would be a good witness. I may be wrong on this. I mean, Peter Drucker has a book on managing the nonprofit, and he has a first chapter in which he says government, business, and nonprofits, those are three. He believes that almost all organizations fit under one of those three headings. I'm sure there's probably a few in limbo, but those are the three. He says each one of them is utterly different, and it's very hard to compare them and to move from one to the other. If any of you have done that, you realize that it's really quite a culture shock. I would say as I told you, my son said, why are they all coming to hear you know nothing about money? Well, I studied for the business sector. I didn't even think about the government sector. But I think if I remember, according to Peter Drucker, the government jobs are the least bottom line oriented. Even nonprofits have to make a profit. But that what government jobs are kind of driven by the people at the top who say, here are our values. Depends on the administration. Depends on the people who get elected, and they say, this is what we want this division to be about. And so if you were, you have to find out whether or not what the elected officials are telling you, this is the job of this division, whether that lines up with what you think would be good for the world or not. But that's not quite the same thing. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay.